Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Here's the old view of our blue planet. The oceans are vast, and man is small. Here's the new view, laid out in a powerful new parade of high-tech maps of the world's great seas. The oceans are vast, and the human footprint is all over them. 40% now seriously degraded, only 4% pristine. This hour, On Point, we'll dive into the latest penetrating view of the world's oceans with the scientists who built it and researchers right now at sea. In a moment, we'll be joined by the lead author of a huge new ocean mapping project unveiled last month in the journal Science. But first, I'm joined by New York Times environmental reporter Andrew Revkin. Andrew Revkin, thanks a lot for being here.
It's great to be with you.
What a series of maps. You got them all over your New York Times. They looked fantastic. They're online as well. And I should say, by the way, we can link to them at our website, onpointradio.org. But describe for us, if you would, Andrew, this project and what it reveals to our sort of meta view of the oceans of this planet.
Yeah, well, my beat is the global environment, so I kind of pay attention to stuff on these large scales. And what's remarkable is, again, as you've said, the oceans were, right until recently, seen as kind of a boundless place. You just take the fish and or whatever and go home and make a lot of money. And we've always been kind of local-oriented as a species, but now with satellite remote sensing and other ways of measuring, you can see things that we didn't see before in terms of big patterns. And now something like 80% of coastlines have invasive species, and probably more. That's actually a conservative estimate. In other words, something that came from somewhere else, probably in a ship in the ballast water or on the hull or the anchor. And the chemistry of the seawater, the surface seawater, is changing as a result of all the carbon dioxide that's building the atmosphere from our activities. And when it goes into, it's absorbed by the oceans, it turns into carbonic acid. So it's slowly lowering the pH of the surface waters of the sea in ways that could have big impacts. And that's kind of the broadest footprint. When you look across those maps, it's all kind of this sort of gold, and that's CO2 enrichment. And I guess we're just getting, we've had a hard time as a species, as individuals, kind of grasping that we can be a global scale influence. I think that's part of the big question about climate. A lot of people, readers of my stories, contact me, and they just can't believe that we could possibly be influencing something as vast as the atmosphere and climate system, and lo and behold, the oceans too.
I'm looking here at just one of these maps on the sort of summary human impact representation here. And I have to say, blue is not a color that shows up much, and that's where the very low impact on the seas would be. It's all the way from blue at the lowest end, just little slivers of it around the Arctic and Antarctic. But when you come to a medium-high impact on the oceans, represented here by orange, and again, you can link to these through our website, onpointradio.org, that orange or gold, as you describe it, covering a huge portion, all of the Atlantic between here and Europe and Africa, a huge portions of the Pacific. I mean, just very little where it's even mild. And then the sort of bright ruby red along the coasts, above all, of Europe and China and the eastern U.S. seaboard, quite large areas where there's been very high impact. These are not just the toss-away portions of the seas, Andrew.
And the strange thing is, looking at the map, you see all those colors, but when you go out and look at the ocean, it's still blue and vast. And a lot of these impacts are absolutely invisible on any particular moment. You go to Montauk on Long Island, a great hub for fishing. You go out there, you catch fish. But what you miss is the history. And when I wrote about this last week, and it's all up on the Times Science site too, you see what's vanished without anyone even noticing. 90% of the great predatory species of the seas, the tunas, the sharks, 80 to 90% of them, in terms of their volume, the mass of fish, is gone from just 50 years ago. And again, you still catch fish, but it's hard to imagine. I grew up in Rhode Island, where I used to see Narragansett Bay boil with these fish called menhaden, a kind of a herring. And when I've gone back more recently, you just don't see that anymore. And they've all literally been scooped up by big purse seining vessels. But you look at Narragansett Bay, it's beautiful. There are boats and there's fishermen. And so the past bounty, the impacts are mainly not the kind of thing that just sort of jars you.
You can see Andrew Repkin's blog, of course, at the New York Times website, the science section there, or a link to it through ours, onpointradio.org. You can also link to these quite amazing maps. Andrew Repkin, please stand by for a moment. I want to go to Eugene, Oregon, and Benjamin Halpern, marine biologist with the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's lead author of this big mapping project. Benjamin Halpern, thanks very much for being with us today.
Pleasure to be here.
Please describe for us what you set out to do with this incredible series of maps of human impact on the seas.
Sure. Well, you know, in the past, a lot of people have really focused on, a lot of researchers have really focused on single activities and the impact we're having through just fishing or just climate change or just land-based pollution. And these studies provide us important insights into the way that we're affecting our oceans, but it's really hard given how many different ways that we use the oceans and how big the ocean is for people to get a sense of that big picture, the cumulative impact that we're having through all of our different activities. And so that was really our goal and our hope in trying to put these maps together, is to finally allow us that view, that sort of view from space of what we're doing to the whole oceans through all of our different activities.
What data did you draw on to put these maps together? Give us a sense of the spectrum of data.
Well, yeah, it was actually quite a massive project, because when you try to do things at global scales, it can be quite challenging to find all the different pieces of data that you need. And as Andy pointed out, there's a lot of satellite information now that we can draw on to get, like, sea surface temperature or ocean acidification estimates from modeling that use in situ estimates from different parts of the world to then predict what's going on. From land-based pollution, we could use satellite information for the types of uses that humans do on the land, agriculture, urban, et cetera, and then develop some modeling frameworks to put that into the ocean. We used, for commercial shipping, we looked at a volunteer observation system where the ships have GPS units on them and track where they go, and that data are all freely available, and we could download it and process it and then convert it into what we needed to use for our purposes. So there's a lot of different types of data out there, but they are quite dispersed, and so one of the challenges in our effort was to bring them all together, which is part of why it took almost 4 years to do this project.
Walk us around this map, this globe, for a moment, if you would, to those ruby red areas on your human impact global map in the seas. Where did you find the deepest, most serious impact, and what would that look like if we stood on those shores or sailed those waters?
Sure. So the largest areas of the most heavily impacted oceans are in the North and Norwegian Seas up by Great Britain and Norway. And in the South and East China Seas, which are off the coast of China and Malaysia and Indonesia. So those are the biggest areas. But there are bright red spots along the eastern seaboard of the United States, the Eastern Caribbean, India and Sri Lanka, the Mediterranean, the Bering Sea, and then smaller patches kind of scattered throughout. And as Andy pointed out, when you stand on the coast, these places are going to look just like blue oceans. So it's going to be very hard to know that there's anything wrong there. It requires you to actually dive underwater and see what's going on in order to get a picture of what these bright red spots are going to look like. And it will vary depending on what kind of ecosystem you're in. So in the South China Seas, there's a lot of coral reefs and mangroves and seagrass beds. In these areas, you're going to have most of the large fish and sharks missing. The corals will be in a degraded state, either bleached or covered with algae. Even a lot of the sort of mid and small-sized fish will be at much lower abundances. There'll be probably sediment and kind of pollution in the water. It'll be just not a very pleasant place to go scuba diving in.
Some of these surprised me, Benjamin Halpern. For example, the Eastern Caribbean, not a major industrial area. In fact, a major tourist destination just for those blue waters. But lots of ruby red, high human impact there. What's that about?
Well, that's exactly right. It doesn't always take a high human population or a high industrial sort of activity to have a big impact on the oceans. There's a lot of commercial fishing around the Eastern Caribbean, as well as a lot of artisanal or subsistence fishing. And then climate change is having a big impact on the Eastern Caribbean. And then those exact tourists and all of the infrastructure that's built up in order to provide services to those tourists produces pollution and nutrient runoff into the coastal waters around those Caribbean islands.
And then what about the Western Canadian coast? I thought of that as just kind of, you know, big forests and pristine seas, but it's bright red on your human impact map.
Well, there's a lot of people living in the Puget Sound area, and
but this red goes all the way up to the Alaskan border and beyond there.
That's right, and there's a lot of fishing and a lot of impacts of climate change going on there. In that case, it's not being driven by sort of large land-based populations of people and the input from them. It's what's going on in the ocean. There's a lot of commercial shipping that uses that route to go across the Pacific, and there's a lot of the northern hemisphere is where a lot of the effects of climate change are being the most profound right now because they're warming faster than the tropical waters.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new mapping of the world's oceans and the human footprint now all over the vast blue seas. Andrew Revkin is with us, science and environment reporter for The New York Times. Benjamin Halpern joins us. He's marine biologist at the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and lead author of this new global map of human impact on marine ecosystems, published in the February edition of the journal Science. Benjamin, I wish you'd sort of walk us down through the human activities which are having the greatest impact, maybe in order of the severity of that impact.
Sure. It actually depends on whether you're thinking about all of the oceans or just the coastal oceans. And the reason to focus just on coastal oceans is that's actually where most of the services that people get from the oceans, fisheries, going to the beach, those kinds of commercial shipping, a lot of those things that we use the oceans for are concentrated in the coastal waters. But if you look globally, climate change is by far having the largest impact or footprint on the oceans. Coastally, climate change is still playing a major role in the impact that we're having on the oceans, but a lot of the land-based pollution and nutrient runoff become major players in driving the impacts, as well as commercial fishing and invasive species, which I believe we'll hear a little bit more about. All of those are having significant impact on the coastal waters in particular.
Now, when you get to the deep sea, there, what has the greatest impact?
There it is, actually, surprisingly, climate change as well. The deep oceans are quite sensitive to very small changes in temperature, and they're already documenting some of these small changes. And that's likely to have, or it's already having some impact and is likely to have a profound impact on these deep ocean areas that, for the most part, haven't seen much temperature fluctuation over the past many millennia.
I was off the coast of Mexico, off the Yucatan, just a week and a half ago, and snorkeling in what seemed to me a beautiful coral reef there. But then I was thinking to myself, I don't really know how this compares to what a pristine coral reef ought to look like. Is part of what you're doing here, Benjamin, sort of helping set a baseline with this work?
That's exactly right. And actually, one of the motivations for doing this project was to try to find where these last pristine places might be so that we could understand what they look like and create that baseline. So what we've done actually provides two types of baselines. One is to find where these pristine places or relatively pristine places are so that we can go and document them and understand that. But it also provides us a baseline of what our current impact on the oceans is so that in the future we can redo an analysis like this and understand how we've continued to change the oceans, hopefully for the better in the future.
Andy Revkin, what's your sense of how the powers that be look out on the seas these days? Is there a wake-up call when we put it all together this way, or do people already pretty well aware of the degradation that's going on?
Well, I think of industrial-scale fisher fleets are definitely aware, but they're just going further and further and deeper to get the fish they need. There's been this sweep. We wrote about this years ago in the Times too. Sort of an expansion of longline fishing, for example, that as they depleted one the water is nearest to home, and that's those red spots, then they just start sort of fishing ever farther away, ever farther away. And there was actually, as Dan Pauly, one of the biologists we interviewed, described it once, it's like watching a sheet of paper burn, to watch the edge of the fishing effort burn itself across the oceans. And what's left behind that is this great diminution. There's a big push toward aquaculture. China has got an unbelievable explosion of aquaculture, raising fish in pens or on shore, you know, freshwater mm-hmm. species. And that has just taken over, actually, I think, the last year or so. Aquaculture-derived fish have now dominated, for the first time, wild-caught fish. But some of that aquaculture is happening in the sea, too. And actually, it's being fed sometimes. If you're growing salmon or tuna in a net, in a pen, you're feeding it fish that you caught or pellets that you processed from fish caught at sea. So it's still not really blunting our overall impact.
Andy, take us back to that. You describe a sort of a passage in 1980, sort of back-to-back contrasting views of the seas in the Western Indian Ocean and then in the Red Sea when you were sailing partway around the world.
Yeah, I was pretty lucky after college. I literally sort of stumbled onto the crew of a sailboat, and I ended up going two-thirds of the way around the world by boat. And it's an amazing way to really remind yourself of the vastness and the power of the oceans to be on a little boat in a big place. And in the middle of the Indian Ocean, we were becalmed, a 21-day passage across the Indian Ocean toward the Red Sea. And we were really bored, and a few of us jumped over the side and with the snorkels and masks. And, you know, it's one thing to snorkel on a coral reef, you know, in a few feet of water.
Right.
It's another to jump off a boat in two-mile depth water and then float away. And within moments, the boat looks tiny behind you, and you look down, and you see your shadow absolutely just vanish
right.
to the vanishing point in 2 miles of vertical ocean, and you feel very, very small, and everything around you seems so overwhelming. And then just a few weeks later, after stopping in Djibouti for a while, we headed up the Red Sea. We anchored behind an uninhabited island in the middle of the Red Sea, very sparsely populated part of the world. You know, the coasts there are not not a lot of people,
right.
but there are a lot of ships. And I walked to the far side of the island, the windward side, and the beach all above the high tide line was thick, strewn with light bulbs, of all things, intact light bulbs, all kinds, you know, fluorescence, incandescence. And these are the few bulbs that would have bounced just far enough above the tide line not to shatter.
Yeah.
And that was jarring. And so I had these two visions that I wrote about last week of the untouchable ocean and the very touched ocean. And again, in a way that no one probably recognized. Some guy on a ship, you know, there's a burned out bulb, you toss it over the side, you don't think about it. But that stuff, that adds up. And that's what I think we've seen, what scientists are finally articulating in a graphical way, is that kind of slow drip kind of influence can add up to momentous changes.
And that's in 1980. Let's get out on the high seas right now, right here today, through the magic of all the satellites and everything else in the world. We're reaching out right now to the good ship Roger Revelle. Kevin Spear joins us. He and his crew and ship are, in Antarctic waters near South Africa. He's a physical oceanographer at Florida State University. Kevin Spear, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Where are you exactly, sir?
Well, your timing is perfect. We just crossed the Antarctic Circle. We're actually at 66 degrees, 33 minutes south, about 3 weeks out of Durban in South Africa, so we're actually close to the Antarctic continent now. Just a few minutes ago, we crossed the Antarctic Circle.
And when you look off the prow of the Roger Revelle there, what do you see?
Well, we see 15 to 20-foot waves. Winds are down a little bit. We just went through a storm a day ago with winds in the 70-mile-an-hour range, 40-foot seas, so we're happy to be out of that.
I need my Dramamine just hearing about it. What are you heading off to research there, Kevin?
Well, this program is a program to study climate variability, funded by the National Science Foundation, who, by the way, also funds the ship. The captain, David Merline, and myself, with the ship's crew and the rest of the scientists aboard, are in sort of a partnership to measure a lot of different parameters on the in the ocean, from the top to the bottom, basically to understand better the carbon system, the role of increasing CO2 in the atmosphere, and the changes that makes on the biology and chemistry and physics of the climate system.
So Benjamin Halpern and his crew have been mapping all this. You're out there in recently 40 and now 15-foot seas, actually on the sea in the Antarctic. What's most important to you, Kevin Speer, for people back on land looking out at all this to know about the seas that you're observing?
Well, what's important to me is that people understand that climate change is real, that temperatures are increasing, that humans are having an impact. And my work and those of the people on board is a little more abstract than actually finding fewer penguins or more penguins or pollution and that sort of thing.
Yep.
We're trying to measure how much CO2 has been absorbed by the ocean. And so we're measuring the amount of CO2 that the Southern Ocean, where we are now, is taking up from the atmosphere. And that's the Southern Ocean is taking up about 40% of the whole fossil fuel input from the rest of the world.
Wow, that's an incredible number. Kevin Speer on the Roger Revell, just crossing the Antarctic Circle. We're very grateful to you for being with us today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Kevin Speer from Florida State University there in the Antarctic. And Benjamin Halpern, I've just called up your temperature map of the world. I guess that's the most relevant to the research that Kevin Speer is doing there. The Antarctic actually is one area where you've still got a fair bit of blue ocean on your map. Not terribly warm, but the warming's coming pretty close.
That's right. Well, it's actually CO2 has two effects on the oceans. It increases the temperature, but that's more through the climate warming effect. And then, as Andy was talking about, it can have an effect on the pH of the ocean. That's the more direct impact it has. And that's through, changing the acidity of the ocean. So currently, the poles are not being as impacted by some of these climate drivers as a lot of the rest of the world. But as Kevin just indicated, it's a coming wave. It's going to be something that's going to affect these parts of the oceans a lot more in the near future.
On the other hand, the Atlantic off North America and the Caribbean looks like an acid bath out there.
That's right. It is being heavily affected. So it's one of the things that is really important about what we've done is the impact that we're having on the oceans is not a uniform pattern. It's not all or nothing that we're doing to the oceans. There's a lot of patchiness to it, and that patchiness creates a lot of opportunity. We can focus on those areas where there's little impact and try to protect or continue to well manage those areas. And then the places that have a lot of high impact provide us sort of guidelines of how we might want to better manage the oceans in those places to reduce some of that impact. So the patchiness actually represents a lot of opportunity for how we can better manage the oceans.
You can link to these amazing maps at our website, onpointradio.org. You've got the acidification, the ultraviolet light map, temperature, invasive species, shipping, and, of course, overall human impact. Let's go to Belmont, Vermont, and Bettina. Hi, Bettina. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom. Thanks so much for this conversation, and thanks so much for all these scientists that are out there doing this fantastic work.
Amen.
I've been a marine biologist since 91 and started off in the North Pacific fishery and then worked down into the Puget Sound and then all along the eastern seaboard in various capacities from fisheries to marine endangered species. And therefore have been out in the field and on vessels and was really surprised when I was working for National Marine Fisheries in the North Pacific that one of the parameters of our data collection was not marine debris. And so I began collecting that data regardless and was basically told that that wasn't what they wanted.
They didn't want to hear about, human debris because it wasn't a problem?
Yeah, as part of a problem of, the general fishery.
Mm-hmm.
And also when I was working with marine turtles off the eastern seaboard, it was also on dredge vessels, and I was getting data for the marine debris off the coast there as well. And also told by also biologists why I was doing this activity. So in my view, obviously, as everyone else, that's worked in the field, that this is all a cumulative problem, having, going from fisheries through other endangered species in the marine environment and the ecosystem in general.
Did you see a little debris out there, Bettina, when you looked around?
Well, off the New Jersey and New York coast, lots of balloons, believe it or not, floating, which in turn becomes a problem with turtles as they eat them, and then it affects their digestive system. And plastic bags, cans, and then we were doing some dredging off of a naval shipyard in Florida, and the muck down there was almost an oily consistency. And probably quite dangerous to breathe in the volatile fumes coming out of the dredging operation.
Bettina, thanks for that firsthand witness. Sounds like some birthday party balloons may end up in some turtle's gullet. Let's get another call here from Tonawanda, New York, and Mary Lou. Hi, Mary Lou. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've been a scuba diver, amateur one, and underwater photographer for about 25 years.
Yeah.
And I've seen lots of changes over the years. Most recently, last November, I was in the Bahamas volunteering for the Reef Environmental Education Foundation, who are studying the invasion of red lionfish along the eastern coast. And as a person who's enjoyed seeing them in the past when I've been in the Pacific, I was, you know, they're not that common there. And here, we just, every dive we went down, we found them. They obviously don't belong there. And the work that's been done with NOAA has been able to determine that the species that's found there is coming out of an area of the Philippines which supplies the aquarium fish.
And so ending up off the Bahamas.
Yes, and so the assumption here is that people who grow tired of their lionfish in their aquarium and don't want to kill them are dumping them in the ocean.
And so populations get changed. They're more witnessed from a scuba diver. Mary Lou, thanks very much. Andy Revkin, you write about the House of Representatives looking at legislation on the ballast, the water ballast in freighters. Tell us the story of the Black Sea. Was it the zebra mussel?
The comb jelly.
And comb jelly, yeah. What happened?
Well, as I've been writing for years now, various stories, we've become kind of a wearing blender for biology on the planet because we're so mobility and things like pet ownership matter too. Last year, I wrote about Burmese pythons that are spreading in the Everglades, eating all that wildlife and being very happy. And now, yeah, what happened was in the early 90s, a vessel left American waters with ballast water down in the bilge, which is put there intentionally if you don't have a full load to kind of make the ship stable.
Sure.
And then you pump it out. And so this comb jelly, a kind of small jellyfish that's a predator of plankton, got introduced into the Black Sea. And within several years, it had completely upended the ecosystem there. Until 90% of the volume of creatures in the Black Sea were comb jellies just a few years later. And it only got kind of semi-stabilized when another invasive species, another kind of jellyfish, got introduced accidentally. And it started saying, wow, look at this feast of comb jellies. And so they've kind of gone back to being a relatively smaller part of the ecosystem. But it just shows you when you move stuff around that evolved in its own environment for millions of years or hundreds of thousands of years, and you give it a new territory, it can really, really make some big changes in a hurry.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a new mapping of the world's oceans this hour and the human footprint now all over the vast blue seas. Benjamin Halpern is with us. He's lead author of a global map of human impact on marine ecosystems published in the journal Science last month. Andrew Revkin of the New York Times is here as well. You can get to his blog through a link at our website, onpointradio.org. He's author of The North Pole Was Here. We've been checking in a little bit around the planet today. Let's whirl right out there again, this time to the off the coast of Puerto Rico and the good ship, the Nancy Foster. We're joined from the Nancy Foster by Tim Battista. He's an oceanographer with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Center for Coastal Monitoring and Assessment. Tim Battista, thanks very much for being here.
Hi, Tom.
Where's the Nancy Foster? Where are you right now, sir?
We are just off the island, Mona Island, which is on the west coast of Puerto Rico, about 42 miles west of the mainland of Puerto Rico. and we're presently conducting ROV, remotely operated vehicle, operations as we speak.
And how are the seas today? Should we in the snowbound north be jealous of you?
Well, it is a bit warmer down here in Puerto Rico, frankly, but we're experiencing about 4 to 6 foot seas, but just calm enough that we can operate the vehicle today without any difficulty. So it's pretty pleasant here.
You're mapping coral reefs and coral reef damage there. What are you seeing so far, Tim?
Well, this effort here, we have 2 weeks aboard the NOAA ship Nancy Foster, as you mentioned, and this effort is part of a larger NOAA effort to conduct comprehensive coral mapping throughout the Pacific, Atlantic, and Caribbean. So we're focusing here in Puerto Rico, and we're focusing on the water depths from about 100 down to 600 feet, which is relatively moderate depths. We've already done all the shallow water work. Now we're bringing the ships out to do the deeper water work. And we're finding, at least in this particular location, Mona Island, just tremendous examples of coral, all varieties and colors, and really beautiful life. So we're pretty pleased with what we're seeing right now.
That's good news. We're glad to hear it. Is it relatively intact because it's so deep? What have you found at shallower levels?
Well, just the other day we were working out on a bank closer to shore, and there are several conservation areas located just offshore of Puerto Rico, and those closure areas are closed, seasonally closed to fishing, were actually quite healthy, and there was a tremendous montage, colorful display of corals and sponges, all sorts of hard and soft corals, and it looked tremendously intact, and so we're happy to be seeing that.
Benjamin Halpern in Eugene, Oregon, what do your maps show us globally about coral reefs? I thought I was looking at beautiful stuff in Mexico 10 days ago. Tim Batista says it's looking great at down to 600 feet depth off Puerto Rico where he is. What's the global picture?
Well, we found that globally coral reefs actually are being quite heavily impacted, and we've heard a lot of reports to that effect in the past decade or so. But it is true that there are places that are in quite good shape, throughout the Caribbean and the Pacific. There tend to be smaller patches, and they also tend to be in exactly the kind of place that we just heard about, these protected areas, where when you allow the fish populations to be at healthy levels, they kind of keep the whole food web or community of fish and invertebrates intact, and that allows the coral reefs to also be kind of preserved in good condition. When you remove the fish, you get algae overgrowing the coral and kind of disrupting the whole food web. And so protected areas can have a big impact on the health of ocean ecosystems.
Tim Batista in the Caribbean, you're there right now. What's your sense of what portion of the coral reef world in the Caribbean is protected?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
How much of the world of coral reefs in the Caribbean Sea is in fact protected, and how much is vulnerable to fishing, overfishing, destruction?
I don't know the numbers offhand, but I know just looking at the small location on the west side, we're talking about probably close to 500 square kilometers of protected areas. And Puerto Rico has been very proactive. The fishermen have actually been engaged in helping to push those closure areas. They recognize that there are important fish species that are associated with these habitats, and they have been pushing the regulatory agencies to close those. Just as the last person mentioned, these habitats are critical for concentrations of fish. They come here to spawn, and so we basically are closing these small areas and hoping for spillover effect into other regions outside the closure areas.
Tim Batista on the Nancy Foster off Puerto Rico. Thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Good talking to you.
Andy Rivkin, how do you see the prospects for recovery, or are we still on a downward trend line across these many vectors in the sea? You know, Tim's hoping for spillover effects from closure that would actually help bring some reefs back. Can we hope for that with reefs or more broadly with the seas, or are things getting worse still?
Well, it's kind of a race. We're in a race between our potency, which is growing quickly, and our ability to measure our impacts, which, as you've seen in these papers, is kind of just still emerging. The impacts are going to grow. We're heading toward a world with probably two more Chinas worth of people in the next 50 years, so heading toward 9 billion, more or less. That's by the way, my beat.earth, my blog is how do we get through, how do we thread that needle? How do we get toward 9 billion people without really wrecking things?
Yeah, there's a question.
And the questions are unresolved. So the pressure is intensifying. Aquaculture can help if it's done in certain ways, but often it isn't. And there are definitely success stories. St. Lucia in the Caribbean is another place where fishermen were very reluctant initially about marine protected areas, but then were kind of when they saw that it actually did boost the commercial fish that were available outside those areas, they became more supportive. So again, that's the race, the tension.
And Benjamin Halpern, are you also tracking over time? Do you see evidence of trend line here, or are your maps a still snapshot? Do you have hopes for recovery, or do you fear, as we go toward 9 billion, that the maps will look worse if we come back in a year or two?
Well, we did only map what was currently going on, so we didn't include any of the historic impacts or the future projected impacts, which suggests that our maps are actually conservative in that sense. And I do think that, you know, if we're not careful, very careful, that the increase in the human population is going to make it quite challenging. But I've done a lot of work on marine reserves, these marine protected areas in my career as well, mm-hmm. and they do offer quite a lot of hope. When you set aside areas, even just protecting them from fishing, which is just one of the many things that we do to the oceans, you see that the oceans can rebound, can recover, and can provide a lot of the services that we care about in the oceans, not just within the boundaries of the protected areas, but also outside of them, this sort of spillover effect. So there, I think there is real promise if we move pretty quickly and hopefully in an intelligent way for better managing our oceans.
Let me ask you about another map here. You've got one that shows tracks ultraviolet light in the seas. What's the significance of ultraviolet light? Heavy concentration in a band around the equator, but lots all over. What's the meaning of that? What's the cause and what's the impact?
Well, the impact is just like us going to the beach and getting a really bad sunburn. All organisms at the cellular level are affected by UV radiation, and when you increase that UV radiation, you cause cell damage, just like when you get a sunburn, and that causes a stress to all of those organisms. It often won't kill them, but the more stress you have, the harder it is to just do your other daily functions like feed and reproduce. So as UV radiation is increasing, we're just stressing these organisms more and more, making it harder for them to cope with all the other things that we're doing.
And why is UV radiation increasing?
Well, one of the causes is the ozone hole. So where you remove ozone, you remove that protective layer and more UV radiation comes in. And then I think this is beyond my field of expertise, but I think there are other sort of atmospheric science reasons that explain why you get the patterns that we see in our maps. It's probably reflectance through clouds and things like that, but it's really outside my area of expertise.
But the impact there directly on sea life, not changing the waters so much as affecting the life within them.
Exactly.
Let's take a call from Charlie in Long Island, New York. Hi, Charlie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, 55 years on Long Island, currently in the Hamptons, and what I've noticed is a terrible, terrible deterioration of water quality. And our biggest problem, it seems, is sewage pollution. Non-point source runoff created by the fact that we've overdeveloped and hardened our lands now with all of our different developments, parking lots, shopping centers,
yep,
roadways, and the natural filtration that we used to have in the good earth and the good marshlands and the good swamps is now gone. Whenever we get a rain, the oceans become totally uninhabitable as far as I'm concerned. Surfing a lot, I'm on antibiotics 6 months a year, and I no longer go in that water because it's so damn dangerous. And a woman before was talking about what she saw in high tide marks. Well, I can tell you that after a rain, coupled with the fact that we no longer have the soft filtration that we used to have, but we have antiquated sewer treatment plants that have to totally open their gates to taking out the solids from the water when we get any more than a quarter inch, and the water is just literally toxic. And the high tide mark that I see is littered with tampon inserters, condoms, hypodermic needles, balloons, styrofoam, all types of products. And as you well know, if you're keeping abreast of things on Long Island, New York, we no longer have a scallop industry. We no longer have a clam industry. In the 50s, my father used to yell at my mother and say, "Get that kid off the deck. I'm baiting a swordfish." And we were half a mile off the beach. Now those swordfish come from Panama. We are in serious trouble. And just to leave you with this thought, I do have a marine biology background, and I keep a coral fish tank. pH of water is supposed to be between 8.1 and 8.3, if I'm correct. I take pH of all water down here on Long Island, and sometimes it's as low as 7.7. That is an extremely dangerous situation, and I'll hang up and just hear the feedback from your experts.
Wow, Charlie, fisherman and surfer, 55 years old. Andy, it sounds like Charlie may take up video games, but not happily there. I mean, you hear the passion, what he sees lost.
Yeah, well, again, some of this comes with age. You know, I'm 52, almost 52 now, and when you've lived long enough to actually experience these changes, it really can make you passionate. As I said, when I was growing up in Rhode Island, I worked for the state Marine Fisheries Department before I was a journalist in summers. And we used to there was an old guy, an old codger who would clean the place, Jim Pimentel. He used to say, and we were studying lobsters, and he'd say, you know, when I was a kid, we used lobsters as cod bait. And that certainly wasn't the case when I was a kid, and certainly won't be the case when my kids have kids. And it's those slow drip things that he mentioned. Non-point source pollution is a big deal. I did a story for the Times a couple of years ago when the National Academies came out with a study that said all those little drips at the gas station, you know, the dribble as you take the thing out of your car, add up to about one and a half Exxon Valdezes in coastal ecosystems on the East Coast every year.
Good Lord.
So the slow drips do add up, and they do transform things in ways that you might not notice day to day, but that can really suddenly just wake up one day and say, oh, my God, what happened to our oceans?
Benjamin Halpern, is there any way then, if you get that bigger population and much of it along the coast and the kind of hardening that our Long Island caller Charlie describes from parking lots and all the rest, I mean, is there any way to have those billions living along the seas and not have all their detritus end up in the seas?
Well, it'll definitely be challenging. And I, you know, one of the biggest challenges is this sort of political and social inertia. You know, to make changes in order to better manage the oceans is going to take a real, I think, movement, political movement, to get a lot of the regulations and laws changed so that the incentives are there to better manage and protect our oceans. There's a lot of creative things being done. It's not just, you know, putting in protected areas, which is a good, you know, option. But there are ways to better manage fisheries through catch share systems, which gives ownership and responsibility to the fishermen so that they have an incentive to better manage the fisheries. And if you can create some sort of system for the costs of goods to reflect the environmental costs that they have, then, you know, the way that people buy things and the way that they manage their own yard and develop areas will be more expensive if it has bigger impact on our ocean. So there are ways, quite clever ways to do this that create incentives for even a larger population to be better managed in the oceans, but it's not going to just happen. We actually need to be doing something.
Let's head on down the coast to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, and Mark. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I've got a business I run here. I do a dolphin watch off the coast here in Murrells Inlet, and I've also worked in Hawaii during the 90s as a dive master and doing whale watches and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And from the moment I got in Hawaii through the 7 years that I lived there, I watched the reefs there in a very short time become bleached and algae overgrown, and then also the impact of, you know, even though I was in the tourism business and tried to educate people on their impact down there, I saw a lot of just lazy behavior from people stomping on coral reefs, and I watched really beautiful areas such as Molokini. It sickened me one day to see this giant growth of antler coral that probably took 100 years to grow, and then just one moment of not paying attention, somebody at some point just knocked the thing over and broke it.
Oh boy.
Turtles with lesions that they say are from golf course runoff or possibly out of the chemicals that they use in sugarcane fields. Just turtles that are blinded by these growths on their eyes, and fish with lesions on the fish, you know, when he was talking about earlier, the UV. Here in South Carolina now, what I see is you know, people coming here in masses to this beach. And you know, years ago, the beach was the thing, and now the beach seems to be secondary to all of the other distractions and attractions that go on here. And you can walk the tide lines, you know, after the tide moves out and up in the tide lines. It's just full of debris and plastic. And while I'm on my dolphin watches, one lady had mentioned earlier about balloons. I picked these balloons out because of their impact on turtles. The estuaries and the river systems that flow in here, such as the Winyaw Bay and the Waccamaw River, I travel up through there. Recently I went up, and I was dumbfounded by the amount of garbage that was piled up in these rivers, you know, on log jams and stuff.
Mark, we've got your testimony, and the clock ticks down. Boy, there it is again. It makes you want to go out with a rake and a shovel and a change in policy and just clean it straight up. Well, the time has flown by. Benjamin Halpern, we're grateful to you for your work on this map and all your work in Santa Barbara. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Andrew Revkin at the New York Times, .earth is the blog. Andy, it's always great talking with you. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Clean up those oceans. This is On Point.
Mother Sea. Below the waves, the ocean planet thrives. History written through other creatures' eyes. Listen close, the secrets they will give, and in a song.